Welcome to Mystery Books Podcast. I'm mystery author Sarah Rosette. This is Season 5, Episode 7, and it's all about Chapters 11, 12, and 13 of Murder at Archley Manor. Murder at Archley Manor was published in 2018, and it's book 1 of 8 in the High Society Lady Detective series. Today we're going to do a deep dive into the upstairs-downstairs life of the English country house. I'm focusing mostly on the downstairs aspect, the servants, and how they lived and what was expected of them. It's a very interesting look at a way of life that pretty much doesn't exist anymore, but I found a lot of the details about the servants' lives interesting, and I tried to incorporate those into Murder at Archley Manor. And since these chapters deal with some of the maids and the things that they went through during this time period, I just thought this would be an interesting thing to look at for these chapters for this episode. But before we get to that, I want to give you a book recommendation. Currently reading Nosy Neighbors by Freya Sampson. Now, this is a really fun book. It's not a puzzle mystery. It has a mystery element to it. It's about a woman who, an older woman, we have two narrators. One woman is older. She's retired. She lives in this, I wouldn't call it a stately home. It's like probably a very nice townhouse type, a home that would have been used by the gentry in the turn of the century, probably Edwardian times. And it's in a small town in England, and it's been converted into flats. And so she knows all of her neighbors, and she keeps track of them all. And she's very particular about things. Her name is Dorothy. And the book opens with a young woman coming to sublet a room from one of the other neighbors in the flat. And her name is Kat. And Dorothy is not excited about this at all. She thinks that Kat is trouble from her pink hair and her tattoo. She can just tell. So the contrast between these two women, Kat's very young. They both have issues in their past that you learn about as the book goes on. And it's more a book about the characters in the house where they live. It's called Shelley House. It's on a lane called Poets Drive. And so it's more about these people learning to come together and become friends. There is a mystery in it, but I really enjoyed it mostly because of the friendships that develop between the different characters. So I'll stop there so I don't spoil anything, but the link to that Nosy Neighbors by Freya Sampson will be in the show notes. Okay, on to the downstairs servant life of an English country house. So if you've watched shows like Downton Abbey, you know that the class distinctions in England in the 1920s were very sharp. People could move up and down through the class system, but if you started out as a servant, it was difficult to move up. It could be done, but things were more set than they are now. Times were changing, but the roles and expectations of servants were mostly unchanged. They were to be seen and not heard. They had back entrances that they used. They had servant staircases when they went up and down to do their cleaning and their chores or activities, the things that they were required to do. They lived in rooms away from the main areas of the house. So they did live in like the little rooms in the attic at the very top of the house. And then they had the servants' hall and the servants' quarters where they spent most of their time. And if they were seen in the main parts of the house, it was usually because they were cleaning something. They were making the fires. They were polishing the wood. They were doing something that was related to their jobs. And if one of the family members, the gentry or aristocracy, whoever lived there and owned the house, came in, the servants were supposed to finish their task and depart as quickly as possible because they were supposed to be invisible. And that was their training. There was a hierarchy. Top tier would have been the butler, the housekeeper, the cook, the ladies' maids, and the valets. They were the highest. And then the very, very lowest would be the boot boy and the scullery maid. And they would have been maybe in their early teens, maybe younger, and they would work all day, especially the younger members of the staff. The lower staff would have worked just hours that we probably couldn't even endure today. I think they were probably much tougher than we are now. But they each, like, the hierarchy was that you'd have the top tier, highest ranking servants, and then everyone else was stratified underneath that. So wherever you were, there was always probably somebody above you and somebody below you. And it was very regimented. The servants did very hard physical work. I'm going to read you an excerpt from a blog post from Maren Allingham's website. She has an article about the servants' lives, and I'll link to it in case you want to look at it later. But I think this little paragraph describes a lot of what their day was like. So this is a quote. "Servants' lives were hard. By 6 o'clock in the morning, the house would be humming with activity. Before the family came down to breakfast, boots would be cleaned, lamps filled, grates cleared, and new fires laid. Carpets would be swept and furniture dusted and polished, all done as quietly as possible so as not to disturb those sleeping upstairs. By 7 o'clock, the housemaids would have brought the lady's maid and the housekeeper their cups of tea, and the butler would have opened the shutters and doors. In the next hour, there would be deliveries to check and to organize from the estate gardens and from local tradesmen. And once the servants had eaten breakfast, the kitchen staff would prepare the buffet for the family and the footmen would lay out the breakfast table. Morning tea would be taken to family members by the valet and lady's maid." End quote. So that was from Maren Allingham's blog, and she is also an author. I will link to her one of her books in the show notes. She has a series set in England in the 1950s, and the first one is called The Bookshop Murder. So that link will be in the show notes. You can see right there that all would happen probably beginning at like 5 a.m. And that's just a couple of hours of their day. And their whole day was filled with physical work like this. So they really had very little time of their own. Servants typically had a half day off once a week, but it wasn't guaranteed. If there was a big event, if something happened that required more people than normal, they just didn't get their day off. It was very difficult to have relationships. The staff and servants, relationships were frowned on or outright forbidden. It was thought to interfere with their work, and overall, it was just something that wasn't approved of or encouraged. Even though it was very, very hard work, there was job security in it. And if you lived in a small village, that might be basically your only option, especially before the Industrial Revolution. Working at a country house was considered a good job, a steady employment where you could survive. It even became a tradition. Some families, the children would eventually take the same job that their parents had done. So maybe the gardener's son would eventually become the gardener, the head gardener. Now, I took a little research detour checking out when major kitchen appliances and other types of modern conveniences were invented, because I just thought, you know, a lot of these things were changing and there were a lot of inventions at the turn of the century. So I did a quick check. The refrigerator was invented in 1913, the electric stand mixer in 1908, the electric toaster in 1909, the electric washing machine in 1907 or 1916, controversy there on the actual date and actual inventor, and the gas-powered lawnmower in 1902. So those are all, you know, with patents, it's sometimes difficult to track down the first one that was patented. So these are the general dates that come up when you do a search for when things were invented. Then we also had the modern dishwasher that used water pressure to clean dishes was invented in 1866 by a woman named Josephine Cochran. And I just thought this was a fascinating story. I hadn't heard it, and I'm going to share it with you because I think it's very interesting. She was a socialite in, I believe it was Illinois, and she gave fancy dinner parties, and her servants didn't do a great job washing the dishes. She had fancy china, and so she decided she would wash them herself. And she chipped some of her plates and had some difficulty with that. And so she decided, fine, I will just invent a dishwasher. So she went out and created a dishwasher that used water pressure to wash the dishes. It had the rack, like we know today, that separates the dishes. She eventually got to demonstrate it. I think it was at a World's Fair. And then after that, they had orders. She started out just building these for her family and friends. But then once word got out about it, people wanted it. And they set up a company, and she owned a company that produced electric dishwashers. So, and that was in 1866 was when she patented her dishwasher. And I just thought that was a fascinating little rabbit trail that I went down, and I thought you would enjoy that. So while all these things were invented and available, that doesn't mean that they were actually in use at these times. So it would probably have taken quite a few years for these to become common, especially the bigger things like the refrigerator, the washing machine. That would probably take quite a few years for that to be implemented in most country homes, if ever, back during this time period. Even the electric dishwasher didn't really become, not standard, but just more common in homes was around the 1950s. And even in many countries today, dishwashers are not a thing. You just wash your dishes by hand. So even though these inventions were available, that doesn't mean that they were in use. And most likely, they probably weren't. And most things were done the old-fashioned way with elbow grease. So it was an interesting time for the servants, because even though they had job security, things were changing, and this way of life was beginning to fade out. So with the grueling work and the long hours and the lack of personal freedom, you can see why in the 1920s, many servants were looking for other types of work. And that is a good point to take a break and listen to the audio from Elizabeth Klett of chapters 11, 12, and 13.
Chapter 11. As Violet and I zipped through the sun-speckled shade of Archley Manor's grounds, I swung the steering wheel of the Morris back and forth, following the curves of the road, readjusting to driving on the left side of the road. I'd last driven in America, and was glad to have a few acres to recalibrate my brain to English driving. By the time we came to the gates, I felt confident, and swung the motor toward the little village closest to the estate. The papier-mâché unicorn guarding the gate was gone, and I wondered if some of the partygoers had taken it with them when they left. It would be just the sort of thing that Set would find hilarious, driving back to London with a huge unicorn sticking out of their motor. The summer sunshine was warm, but the breeze kept it from becoming too hot. Violet had been silent, and I left her to soak up the sun and feel the wind pulling at her hair and clothes. When I slowed down in the village and rolled to a stop in front of a cottage with a blue door and white shutters, she said, "I thought we were going to London." "We are, but first, one quick stop. Wait here. I shouldn't be a moment." The blue door opened, and I introduced myself to a woman who wore a house dress and apron and had her dull brown hair pulled back into a bun. I explained I was looking for Mr. Brown. "He's out, off to Finchbury Crossing." "To the train station?" She looked over my shoulder to the pale green car. "That's right. I don't suppose you're wanting to hire him?" "No, I only want to ask him a question about last night. Did he get a telephone call from Archley Manor late last night?" "That he did, nearly midnight. Picked up a young woman at the gates, he said. Drove her to Finchbury Crossing and waited until the last train arrived. He saw her safely on the train to London. Said he didn't feel right about leaving her there at that time of night." "Thank you, that's helpful. When will he return? Later this afternoon?" She confirmed this was the case, and seemed slightly offended that I obviously wanted to hear the story from her husband. I returned to the motor. "What was that about?" Violet asked. I was glad to see the interest in her eyes instead of dazed blankness. I explained, and she asked, "So you thought Jane might not have left?" "I didn't know. Best to find out exactly what she did rather than speculate, don't you think?" "Yes, I suppose so." "What do you know about the argument between Jane and Alfred?" I asked, skimming along the road to London. Violet's chin came up. "Nothing. Alfred was absolutely unreasonable. He refused to tell me what it was about."
"And then you and Alfred argued?"
"Yes." "Did it happen often? Alfred arguing with the servants, or anyone else?"
"No, of course not."
Her response was so quick that I looked away from the road, but her head was turned away and I couldn't see her expression. Violet said, "I think I'll try and sleep a bit." She put her head down on the seat, closed her eyes, and didn't move until we arrived in London. Jane's sister lived at a much better address than I did in London, a neat little terraced house almost in Kensington. I parked the motor and gently shook Violet's shoulder. "We're here." Violet blinked and sat up, a confused look on her face. "We're in London at Jane's sister's lodging house." Violet straightened her hat and smoothed her dress. "So, what do? Ring the bell and ask to speak with her?"
"We won't have to do that if we can catch her before she gets too far."
I tilted my head in the direction of a woman with short white blonde curls and a flower print dress who had come out of the front door of the house. She walked quickly down the stairs and past us, moving at a good clip down the sidewalk. She never looked our way. Violet twisted her head around to watch her, then looked back at me.
"That's Jane. Are you sure?"
"I think so. It's amazing what a bob and new clothes can do." I climbed out of the car and hurried after the woman. I caught up with her at the next corner as she waited for a break in the traffic.
"Jane?"
She turned and her eyebrows rose.
"Miss Olive?"
"It is you," I said. "You look a bit different with your hair shorter, but I thought it was you." The fair-haired bun that had rested at the nape of Jane's neck was gone. Her hair curled in short tendrils framing her face. She touched the ends of the curls.
"It's quite different. I'm not sure if I like it."
"It's very becoming," I said, as Violet arrived at my side. Jane eyed her with what seemed to be a wary expression. I glanced at Violet. She had a scowl on her face as she studied Jane's new look. Tension vibrated in the air between them. Perhaps bringing Violet along hadn't been the best idea. I'd thought the change of scene would do Violet good, but the animosity she was projecting toward Jane might make it hard to convince Jane to talk to us. I said to Jane, "You look as though you're in a hurry, but I'd like to ask you a few questions if you can spare a few moments. Something rather tragic happened last night at Archley Manor after you left." Everyone loves a mystery, and the intrigue must have piqued Jane's interest because she checked her wristwatch.
"I do have a few minutes. There's a Lion's this way."
Once we were settled at a table and served tea, Jane said, "I suppose this is about why I left so suddenly, isn't it?"
"Yes," Violet said. "Why did you leave your post and scurry away in the middle of the night?"
I sent Violet a warning glance as Jane said, "It was a silly thing to leave like that. Of course, if I'd not had my sister to go to, I wouldn't have done it." Jane had been stirring her tea. She put the spoon down with a click. "I'd had enough. I wasn't going to put up with it any more. I considered staying through the end of the month, but..." She pressed her lips together for a moment. "I know he's your fiancé, but he can be... bothersome." Violet looked a little surprised at this burst of honesty from the former maid. A day ago, I doubt that Jane would have ever made the statement, but this was a new woman. The bobbed hair and bright frock weren't the only change. Her attitude was no longer self-effacing. Violet's hand tightened on the handle of her teacup. I asked hurriedly, "It was last night that he bothered you?" Jane had been about to take a sip of her tea, but she set her cup down and looked directly at Violet. "I know you're jealous and think he was flirting, but he wanted money." Violet dropped her gaze from Jane to the tabletop. I turned back to Jane. "I'm not sure I understand." Jane opened her mouth, took a small breath, then made a huffing sound. "There's really no way to say it politely, She placed her hand on the table in front of Violet. "I don't want to hurt your feelings, but I swear it's true. It was blackmail."
"Blackmail?" I repeated, and several people in the restaurant turned to look at me. I was stunned. I'd expected her to say Alfred had made unwelcome advances. I lowered my voice and leaned over the table.
"What exactly happened?"
She pushed her teacup away and settled her hands in her lap. "I'll tell you the whole thing, then perhaps you'll understand. Mr. Eaton often stays at Archley Manor. One morning, when he was staying at the manor, he found me in Mr. Blakely's study. I was using the typewriter." She pushed her shoulders back. "I've been learning to type. My sister said that the bank would have an opening soon, and if I could type, I had a good chance of being hired, because she could give me a recommendation. She had her instruction books and sent them to me. I couldn't afford to go to a secretarial school, but Mr. Blakely had a typewriter. So I got up early and snuck downstairs before most of the household was awake to practice." I waved off a waitress approaching our table, and Jane went on. "Mr. Eaton wasn't an early riser. I don't know why he was up at that hour, but he saw me, and he knew I had no business using the typewriter. I suppose I looked guilty when he startled me. He only made some comment about how he'd never seen a maid who could type. He told me to get on about my business and leave everything as it was. I did take the practice book with me, but I was so flustered that I left the paper in the typewriter." She sighed. "I thought that was the end of it. But a few days later, he told me if I didn't pay him 2 shillings that week, he would tell Mr. Babcock. Mr. Eaton had kept the paper I'd accidentally left in the typewriter, you see. He said it was evidence, and he'd show it to Babcock if I didn't pay." "And you were afraid you'd lose your position, even though you were doing it before your day officially began?" I asked. "Mr. Babcock is not the most lenient of people." Jane closed her eyes for a moment, then said, "I gave Mr. Eaton the money. I realise now it was a stupid, stupid thing to do, because the next week he wanted more money. He went away for a few weeks, and I thought it was over, that he'd forgotten it. A bit of fun with the maid, you know. But last night he cornered me and said, 'Don't forget, you owe me 3 weeks' worth now.'" She looked out the window. "I don't know what came over me last night. I decided I didn't want to do it anymore, and I told him so." She turned to Violet. "You saw part of that, I think." Violet gave a little nod of her head. Jane's voice was stronger as she said, "I told him I wouldn't put up with it any more and told him to leave me alone. He laughed and said, 'We'll see about that.' It made me so angry. That was when you called for help with Mrs. Reed," Jane said, looking to me. "Once I had her comfortable, I went upstairs, changed out of my uniform, packed my bag, and marched down the stairs. I knew there was a late train out of Finchbury Crossing. If I hurried, I could catch it, and be in London and with my sister in a few hours. I had enough money saved up for the train fare and to pay Mr. Brown to get me to the station."
"So you caught the train at what time?"
"At midnight."
Violet, who had been so silent, said, "Alfred's dead." Jane looked as if someone had slapped her.
"Dead? But how? Was there an accident?"
"He was pushed off the balcony during the fireworks," Violet said.
"Oh, how horrible."
Jane looked away, her thoughts obviously turned inward, but then her gaze flew back to Violet.
"I'm so sorry, I didn't know."
Violet nodded, and Jane's sympathy must have moved her, because Violet's eyes glistened with tears and she sniffed.
"Thank you."
To give Violet a moment to compose herself, I turned the conversation back to Jane. "Because of Alfred's death, I'm sure the police will contact you."
"Oh, that's true. How terrible. I'm sure my sister's landlady will be appalled, but I suppose I'll have to talk to them. Everything happened exactly as I said."
I believed her. Jane hadn't seemed to be keeping anything back,
or trying to avoid answering our questions. The fact that Alfred had tried to blackmail her was shocking, but I didn't think she was making it up. After all, it would be so much easier to lie and say he'd pressed his attentions on her. I said, "I'm sure they'll want to confirm certain things with you, like what you've told us, as well as the fact that you gave Thea, Mrs. Reed, a sleeping powder." She nodded. "Yes, poor thing." "So you made it for her?" I asked. "Yes, she was in terrible pain and was keeping as still as possible. She asked me to mix the packet into the water and then wait while she drank it so I could take the glass away." "And you saw her take it all?" "Oh yes, she needed it." I looked at Violet with raised eyebrows, indicating that if she had any questions, she should ask them now. Violet shook her head, and after a few more minutes, Jane said she had to leave. Millie had given me Jane's letters that she'd left behind at Archley Manor, and I gave those to Jane before she left. As we stepped onto the pavement and moved in the opposite direction from Jane, I said to Violet, "You knew, didn't you?" Chapter 12. Violet picked up her pace. "Why would you think I knew anything about Alfred blackmailing a maid?" I hurried to keep up with her. "Because you weren't surprised." Violet's steps halted, and her gaze dropped from my face. "Yes, I knew," she mumbled, her chin tucked into the collar of her dress. "How did you find out Alfred was blackmailing her?" I asked. "Did you overhear the argument between Alfred and Jane?" She looked around the crowded street. "Not here. I'll tell you on the way back to Archley Manor." She remained silent until we were settled in the motor and I was navigating through the traffic of London. I glanced at her out of the corner of my eye. She stared through the windshield, gripping her handbag. She didn't look at all like the carefree young woman of a few days before, whose only concern had been dancing at a party. Once the traffic thinned and we were on the outskirts of London, I said, "So how did you find out about the blackmail?" Violet's hold on her handbag tightened. "I knew Alfred wasn't telling me everything. I could tell there was something between him and Jane. That dratted comb fell out of my hair again, and I'd gone to fix it. When I came back down the hall to the ballroom, Alfred and Jane were over to the side in a dark corner. I couldn't hear what they said, but they were arguing rather fiercely. He leaned in and said something with great emphasis."
"And you couldn't hear them?"
"No, but I could see Jane's face. She had the last word. Alfred wasn't happy. When I asked him about it, he would only tell me that it didn't matter, that it was nothing."
She turned away. It was harder to hear her voice as she said, "I jumped to the same conclusion that you did, that Alfred was flirting with her. Alfred wouldn't say anything else. I went off to dance with another chap."
"Trying to make him jealous," I thought.
Violet went on, "I danced 3 or 4 dances with other boys. Then, because it was getting close to midnight, I went off to find him."
"And I bet you asked him about it again." Violet was one of the most persistent people I knew.
"He couldn't expect me to just forget it. I found him at the side of the ballroom, laughing with some chaps as if nothing had happened. When he saw me, he said it was time for the fireworks and we should go to the balcony upstairs for the best view. I went, but I asked him if he was ready to talk about what had happened, and he refused. And that was the last time I spoke to him."
Violet's voice trembled. She took a handkerchief out of her handbag and pressed it to her eyes.
"I didn't speak a word to him on the stairs. I wanted him to realise just how angry I was."
I tried to work out the timeline in my head. Alfred and Violet went upstairs shortly before the fireworks started, and I'd seen Alfred pushed over the balcony at the beginning of the fireworks display. Something was off. I slowed the motor as we caught up to a lorry on a narrow stretch of the road.
But you said you never went outside on the balcony, that you went to your room instead. How could you know he was blackmailing Jane if he didn't tell you before the fireworks started?
Violet jerked the handkerchief away from her face.
Because I was so infuriated, I couldn't stay in my room. I waited a few minutes, then slipped into Alfred's room. He was on the balcony, and I knew he didn't see me because his back was turned to me. He never turned around. Alfred had this little book, a notebook.
She made an impatient gesture, waving the handkerchief.
It makes more sense if I tell you about the notebook first. Alfred and I argued about it.
That's not particularly surprising. All couples disagree.
I suppose. Alfred had a small black leather notebook. I asked to borrow it one day to make a note, but he wouldn't let me have it.
And that piqued your curiosity. But I don't see what it has to do with Alfred's death.
I'm getting there. You need the background to understand it properly. Where was I? Oh, the notebook. He wouldn't let me see it, so of course I was curious. Don't look at me like that. You'd be exactly the same way.
Yes, I suppose I would be. I am a terribly curious creature.
Violet said, Alfred and I were to be married. If he wouldn't share his notebook with me, what else was he hiding?
A good question. I didn't add that Alfred had obviously been hiding quite a bit more than a notebook.
So I decided I'd find it and take a quick peek. Oh, I know that's not the done thing, but as I said, he was going to be my husband, and I couldn't have him hiding things from me. Yesterday, I stopped by his room to ask him a question. As I walked in, he put the notebook away in the middle drawer of the writing desk. So last night, when I was so upset, I decided I'd take his idiotic notebook and see what was so private that he wouldn't share it with me.
She focused on smoothing her gloves as she said, I slipped into his room while he was on the balcony watching the fireworks. I pulled out the drawer, and there was the notebook.
She lifted her chin. I took it back to my room.
Was there anyone else on the balcony with him?
No, not that I could see. But the balcony stretches along the back of the house. Anyone from the other rooms on that side of the house could have come out onto the balcony from their room and joined him there.
That's true.
Lady Pamela and Thea had rooms farther along the corridor on that same side of the house. The French windows from their rooms would open onto the balcony.
I inched the motor forward, hoping to pass the lorry when the road opened up.
So, what was in the notebook?
The first part of it was random jottings, bits and bobs, nothing important. A note to telephone his tailor, a reminder to order more milk.
Can you believe it?
It does seem odd. Did you look through the whole book?
I did. And I was feeling indignant by the time I got a few pages into it. They were such trivial things. Why would he keep me from looking at it?
Her gaze dropped, and she plucked at the trim on her handbag.
But in the last few pages, I found a list of names, of a sort. Across from some of them were dates and amounts of money. A folded-up piece of paper was tucked in the back. It was typewritten, and obviously the kind of thing you'd type up if you were using an exercise book. The quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog, that kind of thing.
Jane's typewriting practice.
Yes, I didn't realise what it was then, of course.
So Alfred was blackmailing more people than Jane. Aunt Caroline and Gwen's instincts had been right about Alfred. He wasn't a gentleman. I'd thought he was a slippery one, that too ready smile, but even I hadn't expected him to be a blackmailer.
It does look that way.
You said there were names listed?
Sometimes. One was a single initial J, which must have been Jane. And then there were some that had to be nicknames.
Such as?
Well, there was a Lady Snooty listed. I figured that had to be Lady Pamela.
Most likely.
That was the most obvious one. The others, I wasn't sure who they could be,
Violet said. Well, this is interesting.
What do you mean?
The road finally widened and I shifted gears. We zipped around the lorry. Blackmail is an excellent motivation for murder. Do you have the notebook with you?
No.
You left it in a safe place, then? Violet didn't answer, and I turned toward her.
You did hide it. I suppose it's safe enough in your room?
She raised her chin.
No. I burned it.
You burned it? The wall! Watch out for that wall! I was so shocked I'd let the Morris drift to the spongy earth at the edge of the road. I jerked the wheel, brought the motor back onto the road, and slowed so I could turn to Violet.
Don't you realise you destroyed a piece of evidence that could be used to show other people had a motive to want to hurt Alfred?
I realise that now, but when I found out Alfred had died, I was so shocked. I wasn't thinking straight. I knew I shouldn't have the notebook. I couldn't get it back into his room, not with the police in there. And I didn't know how long it would be before the police might want to search my room. When they found that notebook, how would I explain having it? I'd have to tell them I'd been in Alfred's room. The footman had seen me come upstairs with Alfred. If the police figured out that I was in Alfred's room before he died, then what would I do?
I tapped the steering wheel. The fire in your room this morning.
You weren't cold. That's when you burned it.
It seemed the best thing to do at the time.
You didn't save anything from it?
No. I stirred the fire until even the cover was gone.
I have a pencil and some paper in my handbag. I pushed it across the seat to her. I suggest you reconstruct the list as best you remember.
Chapter 13. By the time we arrived back at Archley Manor, Violet had recreated as much of the information from the list as she could remember. We turned through the gates, and I pulled over in the shade. Violet handed me her list.
This is all I can remember.
Violet had not excelled in penmanship, and writing while the motor was moving made her notes even harder to read, but I was able to decipher the first name. Lady Snooty, I read. I agree, that's probably Lady Pamela, which is interesting. I thought I probably knew what Alfred was blackmailing Lady Pamela about, but I didn't share that information with Violet. I went on to the next word. Muncher? Any idea who that could be? Violet shook her head.
Not the faintest.
And no amount was listed beside this name? Or couldn't you remember?
No, that one was blank.
Perhaps Alfred tried to blackmail this Muncher person but wasn't successful. Perhaps Alfred's list contained blackmail targets as well as people he'd been successful in getting money from. Violet threw herself back against the seat.
It's hopeless. The only one that we have any idea about is the initial J. But we know that Jane was on the train when Alfred died. The only thing we've accomplished today is to eliminate Jane as a suspect.
On the way back to Archley Manor, we'd stopped again at the house with the blue door and the white shutters, and I'd spoken to Mr. Brown. He'd confirmed he'd picked up a young woman with blonde hair at the front gates of Archley Manor a little before midnight the previous evening. He had driven her to Finchbury Crossing, the nearest train station, and waited until he saw her board the last train to London. I knew it was the last train to London, and it didn't stop at any nearby villages. I'd checked the train schedule when I was in London in case Gwen couldn't bring me to Archley Manor.
Violet said, "We're not making any progress."
"I disagree." I tapped the list. "We know Alfred was holding something over these people. Any one of them could have decided they didn't want to continue to pay and pushed him over the balcony."
"But most of the amounts are so small. Trifling, really. Would someone really kill to avoid paying a few pounds?"
I ran my gaze down the column where Violet had noted the amounts of money. The smallest amount of money was listed next to the initial J, while the rest were mostly a few pounds, except for the amount beside the name Lady Snooty. "I can't say for sure those amounts are exactly right, but they were all small." Violet pointed to Lady Snooty.
"Except for Lady Snooty, I'm sure it was 10 guineas.
"Yes, most of these amounts are fairly minor. But think about it.
Would you want to go on paying a few pounds every week for who knows how long, possibly the rest of your life? And what if Alfred asked for more, or decided that he'd rather sell his information to the newspapers?
Violet shifted in the seat, frowning.
I still find it hard to believe Alfred was doing this. I didn't know him at all. Mum and Gwen were right.
It seemed the fact that her sister and mother had accurately assessed Alfred's character bothered her almost as much as his duplicity.
And what do you mean, sell the information to the newspapers? Violet asked. They wouldn't care if Jane was typing away hours before dawn in Sebastian's study. That's not anything the gossip sheets would be interested in.
But we don't know what information Alfred had on these other people, I said, thinking of Lady Pamela. I'd heard her father was a stickler for propriety. Lady Pamela wouldn't want hints linking her with drugs in the papers, but I didn't share that information with Violet. I loved her, but Violet had a tendency to speak before she thought. I turned my attention back to the list and deciphered the next scrawl, which was the abbreviation Doctor. Who do you suppose was the doctor? The one here in the village or someone in London?
Who knows? It's so vague, it could be anyone.
No, it couldn't be anyone. Let's see what we can work out. Did Alfred ever mention going to the doctor? Was he sick recently?
Violet shook her head.
No.
What about your friends? Do you know any physicians?
No.
Or it could be a professor. What about that? Anyone like that in your circle of friends?
Violet gave a little laugh.
No. None of our friends are brainy.
Well, we'll start with the doctor here. What do you think about the last one, Songbird?
Again, no idea. No one in our circle is known for being an excellent singer, except Alfred, of course. No one could sing as well as he could. I can't think who it could be.
Well, we'll just have to find out, won't we? I released the brake, and we rolled on through the extensive grounds around Archley Manor, the dappled shade streaming over us as we followed the curving road. I said, I wouldn't be surprised if the inspector from Scotland Yard arrives this afternoon. He might already be here.
Violet gripped the seat and turned fully toward me.
Scotland Yard?
I overheard the police inspector and the chief constable. They were set on handing the case off to someone else. All of the attention and notoriety it will get has made them want to wash their hands of it as quickly as possible. You should tell the Scotland Yard man about Alfred's notebook.
Oh, I'd much rather you do it. I'll get flustered and say something wrong and end up arrested.
I doubt that. And if I tell them about it, I believe it's called hearsay. You're the only one who actually saw the notebook.
And burned it.
Her shoulders drooped. I stopped the motor on the sweep in front of Archley Manor. As soon as we stepped inside the reception hall, a new police constable met us.
Miss Belgrave and Miss Stone, please come with me. Inspector Longley wants to see you.
Violet shot me a distressed look. I smiled encouragingly and followed the constable down the hall. Violet caught my arm and spoke low.
I don't think I can do it again. Answer all those questions. I know they'll try to trip me up and confuse me and I'll say something wrong.
Nonsense. You can't say anything wrong if you stick to the truth. The constable escorted us to the study. A man, probably in his early 30s, with light brown hair and a thin moustache, was seated behind the desk where Police Inspector Jennings had been the night before. The man had what I supposed would normally be a friendly, open countenance, but at that moment he was frowning and looked severely put out. He stood and focused on Violet.
Miss Stone?
Yes.
Her reply was barely a whisper, and I was slightly amazed to see my normally fiery and energetic cousin answer in such a subdued manner.
I'm Inspector Longley. The investigation into your fiancé's death has been handed over to my department, and I have a few questions for you.
Violet swallowed.
Of course.
But first, I must ask, why did you leave Archley Manor?
Violet twisted the handle of her handbag.
It was... Well, you see...
Violet glanced at me. I stepped forward. "I'm afraid it's all my fault, Inspector." I extended my hand. "I'm Olive Belgrave, Violet's cousin. I ran up to London today, and Violet decided to come with me." He glanced down at my hand. What I thought was a resigned expression chased across his face. He extended his hand. Not his right hand, but his left. The light coming in from the French windows behind him silhouetted his figure, but as my eyes adjusted, I realized his right sleeve was empty and pinned to his jacket. After a moment of shuffling my handbag and gloves, I extended my left hand, and we shook hands. He motioned to a pair of chairs for us, then moved around behind the desk. "Why did you think it would be fine for you to take a little jaunt up to town?" Violet and I took a seat, and I said, "We weren't told to stay here at Archley Manor, and we were returning within a few hours. I didn't see how it could be a problem." "It is very much a problem when an investigation is ongoing and the people I need to interview are not present." "But we're here now. It's not even tea time. Surely your investigation hasn't been thrown off that severely by not being able to speak to us right away. In fact, I bet you only arrived here an hour or so before us." "My arrival time does not matter," he said. But I saw a slight upturn at one corner of his mouth for a brief second. "Now, what was so urgent that it required both of you to go to London?" "One of the maids packed up her belongings and left during the party last night," I said. "She had had an argument with Alfred, and I thought that she was just as viable a suspect as my cousin."
"So you're doing my job for me?"
"I couldn't be sure you would be more open-minded than your associate who interviewed me last night. It was clear that he'd decided Violet was the guilty party and would look no further. I felt it important to present you with other options." At the mention of Inspector Jennings, Longley sighed. "You intended to force my hand?" His tone was less heated than it had been. "If necessary." I allowed my spine to touch the back of the chair. His anger had burned off, and I didn't think he'd snap at Violet.
"I assure you, I won't seize on one suspect to the exclusion of all others. Everything will be considered."
The door opened, and a constable with a notebook entered.
"Good. We can begin now."
Inspector Longley turned to Violet. "I'm afraid I shall have to ask you to go over everything again. It's important we have all the facts clear and down on paper." Violet gave a small nod. Inspector Longley said to me,
"If you'll wait in the reception hall, I'll send for you in a moment."
I gave Violet's shoulder a pat on the way out, then went to the reception hall and paced up and down, unable to sit. About a quarter of an hour later, Violet came out of the study and gave a slight shake of her head as she passed me and went up the stairs. The constable was right behind her, and he escorted me back to the study, where I took the same seat as before. Inspector Longley said,
"I understand from your cousin that the trip to London was fruitless."
"I wouldn't say that. We now know exactly where Jane was, and that she couldn't have pushed Alfred over the balcony. I suppose you would consider it unproductive in one sense, but it seems to me that finding out the truth of the situation is just as important as finding another viable suspect."
"An admirable sentiment, and one I agree with. Your cousin informs me you can give me the former maid's new address in London."
The constable took it down. Then Inspector Longley said,
"We'll of course verify everything you told us."
He left the subject of Jane and took me back through what I'd seen of the struggle on the balcony.
"You can't be more specific than that. Blonde hair and a sparkling dress?"
"No, and I've tried to remember more. Believe me, I have." I'd spent most of the drive to London trying to tease out some small detail that had escaped me. I shook my head. "As much as I'd like to give you some other bit of information, I can't. That's all I remember. It all happened so quickly. It was more of an impression than a clear memory." Longley nodded.
"Yes, well, if that's the case, I appreciate you having the restraint to not make up a helpful distinguishing detail that would clear your cousin."
"I doubt that would work."
"It wouldn't."
I supposed that Violet's warning shake of the head meant she hadn't said anything about Alfred's notebook, which I thought was a mistake. Inspector Longley was not a short-sighted fool like Jennings. I suspected Longley was a man who would pursue all the leads he could find, and it seemed a shame to hamstring him. When he asked my opinion of Alfred, I said, "My aunt and my other cousin Gwen were convinced that he wasn't a gentleman, shall we say."
"They thought he was what? A fortune hunter?"
"No. Violet doesn't have a large dowry, or the possibility of a massive inheritance. No, it was more that they thought Alfred was rather unsavoury," I said, choosing my words carefully.
"And what did they base this opinion on?"
"Nothing substantial. Alfred made several social blunders. He didn't let Violet precede him up a staircase, and he didn't offer his hand at the correct moment during introductions." I sighed. "It sounds like nothing, but there was something about him that was... it's difficult to describe. He was overly friendly, as if he was working extra hard to make sure you stayed on his side."
"And what did you find out about Alfred Eaton?"
I hesitated, and he said,
"Your cousin Gwen told me the family had asked you to look into his background."
"In that case, you should know I was incredibly unsuccessful at uncovering information about Alfred. I couldn't get him to tell me more than the barest facts about his childhood or parents. I came to the party hoping to meet some of his friends and confirm what Alfred had told me, but I didn't achieve that goal either." I told him the small amount of information I had gathered. Longley said,
"I'm sure the Yard will be able to gather a few more particulars."
He took me through what I'd seen on the balcony a second time.
"You're sure it was a woman with blonde hair on the balcony with him?"
"Yes, I'm sure, but that's all I'm positive about." Inspector Longley put down the pencil he'd been holding in his left hand and ran his fingers over his chin as he stared at his handwritten notes for a moment.
"Your account tallies with Monty Park's version, so I have a tendency to think what you say is fairly accurate. Unfortunately, he couldn't give us any more details either."
Longley closed his notebook, reached for an envelope, and shook it gently.
Four strands of pearls spilled onto the notebook.
"Now, why do you have a surprised expression on your face?"
"Because..." I reached for my handbag and took out the pearls. I handed them to Inspector Longley. "I found these on the terrace after Alfred fell. My foot skidded across the top of them. I picked them up and put them in my glove." He took the string of pearls and laid them down beside the other four strands.
"These four strands were found in Alfred's pocket."
He touched the row of pearls I'd given him.
"Where exactly did you find these?"
"They were in front of the doors to the ballroom, the first set of doors."
"Did you find any other jewellery?"
"No, that was all I saw." He swept all the pearls into the envelope.
"Thank you for your time. That will be all."
I was at the door when he said,
"Oh, Miss Belgrave, I'm specifically instructing you to remain on the grounds of Archley Manor. No more jaunts to London."
"That's fine. I don't think I'll need to make any more trips." I left Inspector Longley and went along to the drawing room, which had a subdued atmosphere. Sebastian sat on the far side of the room, conversing in low tones with Lady Pamela, who was draped across one end of a scroll-arm settee. Thea looked a bit pale, but otherwise seemed to have recovered. She had buttonholed James, Sebastian's secretary, who looked at me as a castaway would gaze at a distantly passing ship. Thea was describing the pickled panelling in her London flat, her voice carrying across the room.
"Quite expensive, but as I always say, it never pays to be cheap, you know."
I gave them a wide berth and went to join Gwen, who stood at one of the open French doors that looked out over the terrace and the West Gardens, a teacup and saucer in her hands.
"Oh, there you are," she said as I came to stand beside her.
The window was open, and the scent of roses and honeysuckle drifted inside.
"I heard you return, but by the time I got downstairs you'd been swept off to the inspector. Was he terribly angry with you? Was it grim?
No, it wasn't horrible at all. In a low voice I told her everything Violet and I had learned, and her tea grew cold as she listened without moving. She kept her voice down as well, but anger vibrated through it.
So Alfred was a cad, blackmailing people and threatening maids.
Yes, you were right about him.
But I never suspected he was as bad as that.
Her teacup clattered against the saucer as she set it down on a table. Unfortunately, I don't think Violet told the police about the notebook. Did you speak to her after we returned from London?
No, she went directly to her room. She said she had a headache and took a sleeping powder.
Gwen rubbed the bandage on her hand.
I think she doesn't want to deal with it any more, poor lamb. I'm sure the revelations of the last few hours are a lot for her to take in.
We'll have to convince her to tell Inspector Longley about the notebook. He seems a competent sort.
If you say so.
Gwen's cheeks turned pink. He seemed to be interested in getting to the truth. Didn't you have the same impression?
He had quite a few pointed questions for me.
You have to admit, he seems to be better than the local police inspector.
Possibly.
It wasn't like Gwen to come down so firmly against someone, but perhaps it was because she felt defensive for Violet. Gwen glanced out the window, then surveyed the room before lowering her voice.
I can't help but worry for Violet. I spoke to one of the maids whose brother is a police constable in the village, and he says that there's no evidence against anyone other than Violet. What if they arrest her because there's no one else? Of course there are other suspects. Jane and Thea are washed out, but Lady Pamela was upstairs.
The door opened and Muriel entered with Paul and Rose. They went to Thea, and James escaped with the agility of a mouse fleeing a momentarily distracted cat. He murmured something about a telephone call and left the room. I gripped Gwen's arm.
Muriel! I'd completely forgotten about her. She'd have been upstairs too in the nursery. Granted it's the floor above the bedrooms, but she was upstairs.
Gwen shook her head.
But Muriel has dark hair, and you said the woman on the balcony was a blonde.
There are such things as wigs, you know.
But Muriel?
Gwen looked across the room. She's such a mouse. I don't think she could do something like that.
Do you want another suspect or not?
I asked.
You're right. Put Muriel down as a long shot.
And then there's Lady Pamela, I said.
She said Tug spilled his drink on her and she went upstairs. When did that happen? How long was she upstairs? Did it even happen? Maybe she spilled her drink to give herself an excuse to go upstairs.
And I thought the fierce inspector might have frightened you out of asking questions. He read me the riot act when I told him you were gone. I should have known better. It's my innate curiosity. Even if I wanted to stop asking questions, I don't think I could. Apparently, we're all going to be trapped here at least until the inquest, and I'm not going to sit around doing needlepoint.
Although you do lovely needlepoint, Gwen said, with a mischievous look in her eye.
Thank you. But you know I can't do anything productive while something is on my mind. When Gwen had asked me to help Violet, I'd been reluctant, but talking with Jane and learning about Alfred's notebook had fanned my curiosity. I wanted to help Violet, but I also wanted to figure out who else Alfred had been blackmailing.
Yes, you are a bit single-minded at times, but I don't think Inspector Longley will be happy. He was extremely cross today when he found out you and Violet were gone.
Then he'll just have to be grumpy. There's no law against asking questions.
That was chapters 11, 12, and 13 of Murder at Archley Manor, which was narrated by Elizabeth Klett. I'll be back week after next with the next chapters. And if you want to continue the story right now, you can get it in ebook, audio, or print at sarahrosettebooks.com. Happy sleuthing, and see you next time.